We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of the show, we'll be talking about child protective services here in the state of Illinois, the child welfare system that we have. Last year, the state made some of the first major changes in child protective services in more than 10 years. And I think that many people feel that at this point, things are better certainly than there were than they were in the 90s. We'll try to talk a little bit about recent changes, what they've meant for families who become involved with the public child welfare system, what their experiences are. We'll also try to talk a little bit about how the state determines which children are most at risk, and maybe talk a little bit about what the welfare system can do to support older adolescents. And our guest for the program is Joseph Ryan. He is associate professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign, and has done a lot of research on the experiences of families who become involved in the public child welfare system. He's here in the studio with us this morning. We're pleased that he could spend some time on the show and talk. And, of course, as we talk, questions are welcome. We always invite people to call in. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. So if it's a long-distance call, use that one, 800-222-9455. You can email your question to will-talk, just like it sounds, W-I-L-L-talk at illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions are welcome. We hope people can be brief, but other than that, they're welcome. Thanks very much for being here.
Yeah, thank you, David, for the invitation.
Just to talk a little bit about, look back a couple of years, I think certainly as I read up about it, in the 80s, I think that people thought Illinois' system of child protection was really pretty good. In the 90s, people said they thought it was one of the worst in the nation. The numbers, there were, in the 90s, there was a point where a little over 17 children per thousand were in foster care in Illinois, and that was more than any other state.
That's right.
And I think now, again, more recently, there has been this attempt to improve the system. So having gone from quite good to the worst, where are we now?
I would say we are still progressing towards better. Mm-hmm. The system has approximately 15,000 children in care today. And that's been declining for at least the last 10 years. It's declined probably 20% in the last 6 years alone. And there's been a real attempt, I think, to engage families earlier. So rather than wait until the risks mature into really complex cases, to get families engaged earlier and to get the public to view the child welfare system more along the lines of a voluntary system where people would seek out child protection to support family development.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty startling if we say there are 15,000 children today in care. In 1997, there were 52,000.
That's right.
It seems like a stunning difference, and one would hope that the needs are still being addressed. It's just that it sounds as if what they're trying to do is keep families together rather than removing children from the home.
That's right. So before you would see more families, an allegation of maltreatment was reported, you'd see a higher removal rate. Mm-hmm. And you'd see that by families achieving reunification quicker as well. So kids would come in and out of foster care a lot quicker. Mm-hmm. So the idea is to sort of shift services to more sort of prevention or early intervention side so that we can prevent removing children from the home. Hmm. This also creates sort of a different foster care population if you think of who's left behind, though. So the children who are in care now are probably, on average, more difficult and more complex cases to serve.
Well, and I guess it's my understanding, again, going back to the late 90s when we had these really high numbers of kids in care, that they were there because people who were involved in the system were really afraid that if children were stayed in their home and something really bad happened, that would be really bad. I mean, it seemed like they were really erring. Maybe they were going too far, but they were erring on the side of caution, saying, well, we're not really sure, but let's be better safe than sorry, and let's take the kids out of the house.
That's right. I mean, you know, historically, you know, for the last four decades at least, we see these great swings in terms of sort of just the scenario that you describe. So systems leave children with their biological parents. They try to provide some in-home services, and something really tragic happens to the family. And so the system's response to that is more children come into care. And then over time, we see that a lot of children are remaining in care for longer periods of time. And so we shift back towards this idea of family preservation or in serving intact family cases. Mm.
You know, I have this feeling that there are a lot of people here in the state, maybe a lot of people who are listening, who had never had any contact with the system and never will. But the people who do, I'm expecting that people maybe have extreme feelings about the system, either that maybe some of them think that this is actually a really good thing and that it was very helpful. But I expect that a lot of people, when they think of DCFS, they think, well, this is the agency that takes children from their parents, removes children from the home. How do you look at both of those sorts of things, either on the one hand saying, well, it actually can be something that really helps families, on the other hand, that it's this really heavy-handed government activity that says to parents, well, you're not fit to be parents, so that we're going to take your kids.
Right. There's probably two perceptions. One is that it's an agent of the state that's intervening in private family matters, right? Yeah. Sort of making a judgment call about who's an adequate parent and who's not. So there's sort of the first problematic perception of the system. The second one is, as you described, a system that is there to destroy and break families, to take children into foster care, and to rarely achieve family reunification. So those are sort of the two problems with it. And you can see that because the families who do get involved with the system generally stay involved for quite a period of time. But there's also a larger number of families, significantly larger number of families, that are served in the family home. So sort of children are not removed. I mean, everyone has this perception that child protection, that their one intervention is foster care. And that's not the case. There's more families that are served. I think two-thirds of the families probably are served in a family setting. So children remain in the home. Some services are provided to the family. And so you can sort of see how that perception evolves because everyone thinks of foster care. But it's not entirely accurate.
Yeah. Well, I think that what certainly has happened is I think that particularly recently there has been this attempt to do initially to do some triage and to say, all right, look at this situation. How are these children at risk and what's the level at risk? And do we really think that they need at least temporarily to be removed from the home? Or is this the kind of thing that provided the right kind of help that this family can be okay? You know, how do you do that? How do you make that call?
Well, so, you know, some of the recent legislation to enact this differential response initiative here in Illinois, and it's been going on in other states for probably more than 10 years now. It's a question of sort of upfront assessment. So figuring out which families need to fully engage with the child protection system or which families could sort of better be served with some local community-based in-home family services so that they don't get tangled up with the child welfare system. Part of the problem with the child welfare system is a lot of families get involved with them for, I don't want to say minor allegations, but once you're involved with the child welfare system, it's hard to get disentangled from this system. Because although you might come in for an allegation of neglect, the longer that caseworkers and judges are involved in your life, you know, the more problems seem to emerge. So inadequate housing, lack of steady employment, domestic violence issues, and these things sort of prolong your involvement with the system. So it's really about trying to assess families on the front end and think about it as minimal minimal involvement. I mean, we're trying to get families to this threshold of adequate parenting. And, you know, there's a lot of gray area in there.
Yeah. Well, that then raises questions in my mind about what exactly the problem is. If you're setting aside a kind of situation where there might really be dangerous abuse going on, and where the issue is people who, for a variety of reasons, cannot take care of their children. If you look at that category, really, what is this? I mean, is it that people don't have the financial resources? Is it that they don't have the kind of emotional resources? What really are the big issues?
Well, when you talk about sort of physical violence, I think also people think about the child protection system as a system that's responding to physical abuse and sexual abuse. Mm. The vast majority of the cases are for neglect. Probably 65% to 70% of allegations that come in and the cases that are served are for neglect. So that's really the bulk of the system. So we're talking about parents that are unable to provide a safe and stable home for their children. So that's sort of that's the bulk of the cases that are coming in.
Hmm. Well, and so what exactly does that mean, not being able to provide a safe and stable home?
Well, so neglect could be parents who leave their children without adequate supervision. Mm-hmm. That's a big one. You know, parents could be going to work, parents using illegal substances compromises their ability to adequately supervise their children.
Our guest in this hour, maybe I'll just reintroduce, is Joseph Ryan. He's associate professor in the School of Social Work at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about Illinois Child Protective Services, what the system looks like, what it's designed to do, how perhaps in recent years some improvements have been made to try to get the system to function better. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, it seems that there are still a couple of different things here that if there's one set of issues that might be connected with someone who doesn't know what it is to be a parent. And maybe there it's a matter of education and experience. That's one thing. But then there's another thing that if this family is just in dire need, the parent has to leave to work, or maybe they don't have the resources to take care of the family, not because they don't know how, but because because they don't have work, whatever things that they're dealing with. What really, so there are sort of two different things here. Maybe you can teach someone how to be a better parent, but if this family is struggling financially, what can the system do for somebody like that?
Right. So those are sort of two different issues. The first one has to do with parental expectations. So This is probably the greatest predictor of involvement with the child welfare system. And the bulk, probably a third of the population of kids coming into care are probably four and under. And essentially the expectations, you know, parents have unrealistic expectations of how difficult and demanding it is to be a parent, right? You know, we have kids and we think that, you know, it's going to be this great warm experience. Come to find out, it's a bit more challenging than that. And this idea that we have unrealistic expectations for our children to engage in developmentally appropriate activities. Potty training, for example, is a big risk period for maltreatment, because parents are frustrated over issues around potty training. But to some extent, it's a mismatch between developmentally what kids can do and the expectations for parents. So that's clearly one issue. The other issue, big issue that you bring up, is resources. Poor families are vastly overrepresented in the child protection system. Now, families are not supposed to children are not supposed to come into care for reasons of poverty alone. There's concrete services that can be provided to keep families out of care. Now, that doesn't mean in cases of extreme poverty, children are not removed from the home, but it's not a system that's to move families up out of poverty.
So it's more the thing that you really have to address, or that is charged with addressing, is the first sort of sets of issues. And it sounds like really what the system ends up having to do is to teach people how to be parents. I mean, is that really
to some extent right? Or in cases of neglect or houses that are, you know, problematic wiring, get housing up to standard so that it's a safe environment for children to live in.
So how does the decision get made that maybe at least temporarily a child should be removed from the home and put into foster care?
If there's an indicated report, meaning there's sort of credible, substantial evidence that physical harm took place, so bruises, cuts, and welts on a child, burn marks on a child, or this idea of there's imminent risk of harm. I mean, those are sort of the two criteria, that sort of harm has happened or there's an imminent risk of harm.
And when that happens, what's the average length of time that, that children are out of the home? Do you have numbers like that?
Yeah. So the median is somewhere in the low 20s, 23, 24 months. So once children are removed, that's the median time.
And what, I don't realize this is sort of extreme, but what are there cases where children are permanently removed, and how does that decision get made?
Well, I mean, the idea of foster care is that it's a temporary intervention, right? That children come into foster care, the system's going to engage the biological parent or parents, and that the issues can be adequately resolved so children can return home. So no one really enters foster care as a long-term option because foster care is not a great system. It's not set up to be a permanent family for a child. Now, children could come in cases of severe maltreatment, you know, the death of a sibling, where parental rights are almost immediately terminated and, you know, the system's looking for a permanent adoptive home. But the idea that foster care is not a long-term solution for any child.
Do you have many cases, are there many cases where children end up essentially being in foster care until they're old enough to legally be considered to be adults?
Yes. Right. There's about 30,000 adolescents a year that age out of the foster care system. So that they turn 18, they have no biological family that the state is going to release them to, and so they're emancipated as adults.
Yeah. And do those people, are they kids who come into the system at a fairly advanced age, or that they have been in there for a long time?
No, these are kids who come in later. So these are not children who come in, you know, at 3 years old and spend their entire life. The younger children, they're likely to get adopted. They're likely to achieve permanency, either through reunification, being returned to their family, or through adoption. It's relatively easy to find an adoptive home for a really young child. It's harder, and not surprisingly, to find an adoptive home to a 13-year-old.
And this, it seems like this is, again, a population that there has been some effort to try to address, that the need that they have for assistance. And to get away from the idea that once someone is legally an adult, that doesn't necessarily mean that person is ready to take care of themselves. But the way that the law used to be written was that at the age of legal emancipation, you were out of the system and you were on your own.
That's right. So historically, you know, the child welfare system would provide services to an adolescent until they're 18 and then wash the hands of that particular youth. Now, over time, sort of, you know, even 20 years ago, they would provide independent living services. So try to, you know, recognizing that a lot of these kids didn't have a family to return to, they would engage in independent living services. So this could be living in an apartment, practice apartment with an agency supervision sort of umbrella over you, practicing sort of cooking and basic banking skills, getting a GED. But those have proven sort of insufficient, right? And especially thinking about all the trauma and risks that these kids carry with them, to think that they could live independently and self-sufficiently at 18 is problematic.
I think that you mentioned that the children that you know that there are sort of two sets here, that there are children and families who can benefit by some services in the home where they're not at immediate risk, and that really the idea should is to try to keep the family together and try to help them, give them the resources to make it. And that there are, in fact, a lot of families that with that kind of help, they can. That the extreme cases maybe are the ones where the children have to be removed. But that's then, you said, the toughest cases, though, maybe the toughest cases to deal with. And also, if you're looking to place those kids, they may also be the toughest to place.
That's right. So on the sort of intact family cases, so these are cases that don't come into foster care where the system is engaging with the family, working with the family in the home, only about 4 or 5% of those cases ever enter the foster care system. So you could say on that side that, you know, I mean, you could make the argument that, you know, maybe they didn't need to be involved with them at all, but you could make the argument that that system seems to be working. So if 96% of these cases remain as intact family cases, they close without a child coming into the foster care system, that's a good thing. Once they come into the foster care system, so about 30% achieve reunification, meaning the child's return to the biological parents within 2 years. Now, that's low in Illinois. We're probably one of the lowest states in terms of reunification rates. And there's also great variation in reunification rates. But about 30% of the kids are returned to their family within 2 years' time. That leaves another 70% in foster care or searching for an adoptive home beyond the two-year point. But those are sort of the two main pathways kids go.
We have a caller here. Let's bring them in line number one. Hello.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Hello?
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, hi. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you and Dr. Ryan for the very interesting conversation. And I just wanted to make a comment/question here. You got to talk a lot about families, and there was some brief discussion about poverty, but I was wondering if you guys can talk more about the intersections of race and class and gender and framing how social work policy affects families. In short, or in other words, you know, one of the perceptions about foster care is that social workers come in and break up black families, and that kids who are in foster care, that's the first step towards prisons. And so, in short, I was wondering if you guys can be more clear, or rather talk more about, again, how race and class intersect here with foster care policies. Yeah. Thank you for the call.
Well, thank you. Excellent questions, and I know that that these, in your research, I know that these are things that you have looked at. So.
That's a great question. The overrepresentation of black families in the child welfare system is a long and stubborn problem. The caller sort of talks about the breaking up of the black family. Dorothy Roberts, who's a law professor at Northwestern, has written several books in this area. One's called Shattered Bonds. But so you could think of sort of our general population here in Illinois, or even here in Champaign County. And I think it's approximately 18% African American, and the foster care population is probably 60% African American. So that's sort of on the front end, who's coming into the system. Black families also stay longer in the system, so their exit rates are slower. And, you know, there's real problems with that. If we think of the foster care system as an imperfect parent and exposing kids to probably a wide variety of risks, it exposes African-American youth at a higher rate to these risks. I don't think the foster care system is specifically designed to break up black families. I think it works equally poor for all families. But given the fact that there's black families are overrepresented in poverty, there is this great overlap between African-American families and income. And so it creates problems on the front end. But, you know, then you think about, you know, we're making value judgments about adequate parenting levels. And so you can see where bias comes into it when you enter communities that perhaps as a worker you're not familiar with cultural patterns in terms of child rearing, that you get involved with families, in particular black families, when you probably don't need to be. Mm. So there's certainly there's risks that are that that increase the likelihood of African American families becoming involved with child welfare system, but there's also bias in the system and at all sort of decision points as well.
Yeah. What do you do about that sort of bias? How do you try to address that?
Well, so states and counties try to do a lot of things. One of the things they might try to do is engage in cultural competency training. But the question, and so cultural competency training is sort of a means to try to get families or try to get workers to be more culturally competent in terms of understanding different family dynamics. The question is this something that can be trained, right? Can you learn this in a classroom? Is this some sort of inoculation method where you could get some booster shot of cultural competency training and then go out and work in the world? That's probably not the case. One of the other issues sort of related to this is when we think about social workers, and this is social workers in all domains, there's really there's probably two types of people who engage in social workers. And not to offend anyone, but this seems to be the two types of social workers. There's folks who want to help people and folks who want to judge people. And this creates problems for social work in terms of judging someone's parental abilities.
Well, to go to another aspect of all this that the caller raised, what can you say about particularly for the risk that children who come into the system, particularly older children, have of also ending up having contact with the juvenile justice system?
That's right. So, you know, the longer children stay in foster care, the greater the likelihood that they're going to end up in the child welfare system. So we did a study in Cook County, this was a few years ago, and we followed foster youth who lived in Cook County and then matched with the Cook County juvenile probation records. And we found that about a quarter of all foster youth, male foster youth, had contact with the juvenile justice system. The other thing that's sort of interesting on sort of the juvenile justice system side is that African-American youth in the foster care system have a greater likelihood of coming into contact with the juvenile justice system. And this is somewhat of a peculiar finding that in the general public, the risk for correctional involvement has largely been explained by, well, differences in neighborhood, differences in income. When you have a foster care population, a lot of those differences vanish, right? They become more equal. And you would expect the arrest rates then to be more equivalent. But what we find, and we find this in Pennsylvania, Washington, California, here in Illinois, that African-American youth are about twice as likely to come in contact with the juvenile justice system. So we study this in DuPage County, we study in Cook County, we study it in Peoria, and this pattern is consistent. And so the question that I raise is the experience of the child welfare system different for black families than it is for other families?
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like from what you said in response to the questions the caller raised, that you'd have to say the answer to the question is, yeah.
Absolutely.
It is different.
Absolutely. And one of the biggest differences is probably the placement settings where African-American youth go. So about 40% of foster care placements are kinship care placements. So these are placements that a youth is removed from the home and they're placed either with an aunt or a grandparent, right? That's sort of the most likely scenario. These placements are great for a lot of reasons. They're more stable. The children know the providers. They're more likely to take sibling cases. But they're also treated differently. And I should say this in that African-American youth are more likely to enter kinship care placements. And these placements are treated differently by the child welfare system. They receive fewer services from caseworkers. Caseworkers interact with these homes less often. The payment rates have historically been lower. And so even though these are foster care placements, and at foster care placements in particular for African-American youth, they're not supported as well as stranger or non-kin foster care placements.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we have heard again and again is that caseworkers, for example, people who work for an agency like DCFS, are overstressed. That is, the numbers of cases they're trying to handle is way more than any individual should. And is that something that is still the case? I imagine that it is, and is that a problem?
Yes, I think you could say that. The sheer number, the volume of cases that come through the system, although a lot less than they used to be, right? Mm-hmm. You noted that there were 50,000 kids in placement at one time, and now there's 15,000.
15,000, yeah.
So, you know, you could say that we should have more resources to put towards this. But it's not only the number of cases. It's the number of issues that these families are dealing with. And when you have one casework, you know, sort of a traditional case is, you know, at the temporary custody hearing. So this is where the hearing where a child's removed. You get assigned a caseworker, let's say. And that caseworker is responsible for all of managing all of the family needs. So it could be housing, substance abuse, domestic violence, employment, child care. So it's the sheer number of cases, but it's also the complexity of the cases.
Yeah. Well, and if it's, as we've said, you have to say, well, that's a good thing that if 1997 there were 52,000 kids in foster care and now there are only 15,000, well, that's good. But also if we're addressing the need differently, that is what we're trying to do is provide services in the home to families so that they can be successful, that you still need people to do that job. And whoever it is that does that job, you still have to have the resources to do that. And how well are we meeting this continuing need that families have?
I mentioned that, you know, 95% of these cases don't come into care. So you could say that they're managing those quite well, right, on the intact family side. That even though the system is involved with these families, the vast majority don't experience any removal from the home. Now, you could argue whether or not they're better off now that the system's been involved. You know, the foster care placement is mere one outcome to look at. But, you know, you could say that 95% remain as intact families. That's not a bad thing.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Joseph Ryan. He is associate professor in the School of Social Work at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. And his research and scholarship, he takes a look at the experiences that families have when they become involved in the public child welfare system. And we've been talking here a little bit about the system here in Illinois and how things looked over the past few decades. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you can also email your comments, questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. We have just briefly touched on this fact that there can be this intersection between the child welfare and the juvenile justice systems. And apparently there are some people who think, and I think actually the governor is one of the people who suggested that somehow these two systems should be merged, that it should really be one system. And I don't know how, so some people might feel really uncomfortable with that idea, but I guess there are also some people who think that actually would make sense.
Yes, I'm one of those people who would think it would make sense. So, since we're in Illinois, we know silos well, and child welfare and juvenile justice is a great example of a siloed system, that they operate under separate budgets and largely a separate service system. Although the new director of the juvenile justice, Arthur Bishop, and Director McEwen from the child welfare child protection system. Are developing these shared service models. But these things make sense. You know, that the idea that a juvenile offender, a juvenile delinquent is vastly different than an adolescent in the child welfare system is, you know, the evidence indicates otherwise. These cases are very similar and could benefit from a similar set of family services.
Uh-huh. Well, I know that in your work what you've done is you're looking at, particularly one of the things you've looked at is families that they're involved with more than one system. So, you know, they may have issues, parents may have issues with kids that get them involved in DCFS, but that there may also be a lot of other issues. And in fact, those kids may be involved in the juvenile justice system. Who knows? The adults' parents might be involved in the justice system. It starts to get a lot more complicated, and it's not just a matter of somebody deciding, are these people adequate parents?
Right. So historically, the child welfare system was only interested in the safety and permanency of children in its care. But as foster care, as periods of foster care grow, so kids stay in foster care longer, child welfare systems have sort of taken the perspective, we need to think about the well-being of these children more broadly. Mm-hmm. So it used to be safety and permanency. Now it's safety, permanency, and well-being. And we recognize, and, you know, through these sort of data sharing agreements with different service systems, we see this great overlap between these cases. You know, and back to the caller's point, you know, in particular, this movement, you know, of overlap between two systems for African-American youth. So, you know, we find that open child welfare cases for adolescents, they account for approximately 8% of all arrests, right? And this is true in Los Angeles. It's true in Peoria. Yet they account for probably about 15 or 20% of arrests for African-Americans. So there's this great flow between child welfare and the juvenile justice system that we need to think about. And on the parent side, we run several projects up in Cook County and in Southern Illinois on the overlap between the substance abuse service system and the child welfare system.
Hmm. So they get it seems very quickly it starts to get much more complicated than just single issues.
Right, and also from a professional standpoint, it's problematic because on the substance abuse side, the workers in who are working in substance abuse agencies, the parent is their client. On the child welfare side, the child is their client. And you also have this issue of competing clocks. So if we think of substance abuse, for example, you know, the clock that's ticking for recovery, right? Some might say it's one day at a time for the rest of your life. The clock that's ticking for permanency, meaning we need to find a permanent home for this child, is about 15 or 18 months. So these they can be sort of competing agendas, competing service agendas as well.
Mm. One thing I wanted to go back to, and I believe I asked the question about for children that are removed from their home and put into foster care, how long generally does that last? And I think that you said that in most cases, children are back with their parents in something under 2 years?
Well, not most. So the median stay is 26 months. Okay. So 50% okay. of kids stay longer than that. 50% say shorter that. There's also, as I mentioned, variations by race and ethnicity. That goes up to 32 months for black youth and 22 months, down to 22 months for white youth. And in terms of who's returned to their family, about 30% are returned to their biological family within 2 years.
Mm. I'm just thinking about what kind of experience that is for children who have been living in foster care for 2 or 3 years. What sort of issues there are, reentry issues there are after that going back home?
Right. So, I mean, that's a good question. So we should sort of clarify that children don't go into one foster home, spend 2 or 3 years there, and then are returned. Mm-hmm. And this is certainly true for older adolescents who run from placements that they don't like. You don't see that. You know, that's not really a problem for younger children. But the idea that children enter a foster care placement, stay with a loving family for a couple of years, and then returned home, that's really not the typical case, certainly not for adolescents as well. So kids will go into the foster care system, and they'll largely, certainly adolescents, bounce between foster family homes. And so when you talk about that experience, sure, that's a great disrupting experience in terms of social bonds, right? Our connection to important adults, important siblings as well, right? Sibling relationships are disrupted.
Well, that gets I suppose into another conversation about what the experience it is like for children in foster care particularly if they're going from one place to another place to another place, that kind of disruption, lack of permanence, you have to say that that's not good.
That's right. And as kids experience, you know, greater disruptions, a greater number of disruptions, their likelihood of experiencing problems in school increases. Their likelihood of coming into contact with the juvenile justice system increases. Now, I should say with that, you know, when they survey adolescents in the foster care system, certainly kids who have emancipated, many are thankful for their foster care experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the numbers in terms of their frequency of placement disruptions, you know, might lend to another story. But kids in general feel like they were fortunate to be removed to some extent from their home. It's not that they don't return to their biological parents on their own and still try to maintain these ties, but they are fortunate for their foster care experience.
Yeah. And when kids are in foster care, how much contact or do they have contact with their biological parents?
Yeah, it varies. You know, it could start with supervised visitation, right? That they recognize that, you know, I mean, these kids are going to return to their biological families anyways. So come 18, when kids are emancipated from the system, they're going to seek out their family members anyways. So the system really, it's in their best interest to try to maintain some of these ties.
What are the big problems with having some permanency in foster care? As you say, the average, the thing, the real experience, it's not the idea that children manage to go. There are a lot of really wonderful foster parents, really generous and heroic and giving people who open their homes to kids who need care. And I'm sure that in some of those cases, kids do stay for a long time and people end up actually even adopting foster kids, and that, you know, that does happen. You read those stories. But at the same time, you see these and hear these stories about kids who just bounce around a lot. And so you have to wonder, well, what exactly is the issue here?
There's two issues. Yeah. One is, you know, we talk about the unrealistic expectations from the biological parent's perspective. There's also an unrealistic expectation from a foster parent's perspective. This idea that, you know, it's sort of a warming story. I'm going to take care of abused or neglected child, right? Sounds nice, right? But come to find out, 12, 13, 14-year-old kids are very difficult. And ones with a history of trauma like the ones coming into the child welfare system. And so there's an unrealistic. So parents, you know, essentially want to get out of being foster parents to some extent, right? So that explains, I think, about a third of the moves. So parents saying, foster parents saying, you know, this placement's really not working out. This isn't what I thought it was going to be. You know, I'm interested in something different. And then the others are kids run, right? They don't want to be there. And they're old enough to know that. And they're not that connected to the family. And so they run from placement.
There must be some effort to, if you have a difficult child to place, I would think you would look at placing them with somebody who had the most experience at dealing with difficult placements. But maybe the issue is that there are just too many kids who need foster homes, so you can't always do that.
Right. You would think that that wouldn't be as much of a problem, especially given that we had 50,000 foster homes. You know, now we're down to 15. It seems like we should have increased in terms of the quality of the foster home. But, you know, there's services that are in place like respite care, right? So foster parents need a break, right? And so, you know, a respite care service could be a welcomed break from that to try to maintain that relationship. So there are mechanisms that are in place that systems can use to try to keep these placements from being disrupted.
Mm. About 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus. Again, just real quick, I want to introduce the guest, Joseph Ryan. He is associate professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois, and we're talking about Illinois' child protection system, its child welfare system, and some of the experiences that families have when they come involved in the system, some of the improvements that have been made. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do also have email, so if you'd like to send us a message that way, it is will-talk, just like it sounds, will-talk@illinois.edu. And I think that we have another caller here, somebody on line one in McLean County. They're next. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I just have one quick question. and that is, what happens to children who, once they turn 18, who've been in the foster care system?
So what happens to them in terms of their sort of outcomes? How do they look relative to other kids their age? Or
what kind of support, actually? Maybe you're right, good question. What kind of support do they have? You know, I mean, like, you know, if I had a kid turn 18, they go to college, whatever. If they needed help, they call me, right?
That's right.
Or they have other, you know, family and, you know, support system. You know, because putting a kid out at 18, out the door and say, goodbye, lock the door, in my opinion, is not a good idea.
Right. And systems are starting to recognize that. And that's one of the pieces of legislation that Governor Quinn signed last year, Foster Child Successful Transition to Adulthood Act. And essentially this comes out of, you know, a lot of empirical evidence that these kids actually are not doing that well. So when we look at foster youth who have aged out of the system, we find that almost 40% have experienced homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
Almost 40% have been arrested. Two-thirds, 48% are unemployed. Systems now are recognizing that they need to stay involved with these youth for longer periods of time. And so services now, you know, adolescents can access services through 21. And this is true for kids who have left the foster care system as well, young adults. They can reengage with the child welfare system here in Illinois. And Illinois is really a leader in that. A lot of states don't have this support system set up. But it's this recognition that this transition to adulthood is being stretched out for all kids in the general population. So even at 21, you could argue the average 21-year-old is not self-sufficient.
Right. Yeah.
If you surveyed the University of Illinois graduates at 21 to see what they're doing and see how many supports they're accepting from their parents, it would probably be quite high.
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of services now that are available, including support for education.
Mm. That's good. It's too bad it's not 26, because the law just, you know, about the health care law, we can keep a kid on until he's 26 on your health care.
That's right.
Yeah, so from what I've gathered is that once they get to 18, well, I'm glad it moved to 21, they lose all services. They have no health care. They have no support. They don't have any Social Security from what I gather. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, I think it's a real balancing act, and this is true sort of historically in social welfare. That we don't want to provide too many services or too many supports for this fear that we're creating a dependency on a system.
Right.
And so right now it's moved to 21. Who knows? Maybe it will be slowly moved up to 26
right.
at some point.
Yeah, it would be. And I understand that. But you can also, when you get to 21, you can gradually
sure.
some of the stuff. I mean, you don't. The problem I had was that they at 18, out the door, end of story, and you're on the streets, and that. I mean, that's not a good idea. I think a gradual, I mean, it's like families do, you know? You let the kid go a little further each day.
That's right. So. Right. Some scaffolding.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We're down here. We have maybe about 2 minutes left. And as a way of finishing up, I was just interested in having you talk a little bit about what ways in which you think the system maybe could be adjusted to better meet a need. And here just at the end, we were talking about obviously one need, that is of older adolescents, that the way it used to be, it got to, as the caller said, and as you said, it got to be when they were 18, it was, well, good luck and we'll see you. They were out of the system. That was just it. And so now there have been some changes made to give them at least a couple of more years of support. So at least that's one thing that the system is doing. Are there other ways in which you think that there's really some kind of hole here that still needs to be filled?
I think sort of better screening on the front end and having fewer families come into contact with the child welfare system. So our child welfare system now is very reactive. We wait around until the problem really emerges. So if we could get a system in place that's a bit more voluntary in nature, that's a bit more community-based in nature, I think families would engage with a system like that, be more willing to engage with a system like that, and probably have a shorter length of time involved in that system.
Do you think it would actually, if you had a system where people felt like they if they needed help, they could say they needed help, and then they would know where exactly to go rather than getting to the point where things got so bad that somebody else from outside was looking at that family and saying, this family needs
help. It depends where they have to go for help. If, in fact, they have to call Springfield to some hotline to request help to get it in their community, that's not going to work. But if, in fact, the communities engage local churches, religious organizations, and really invest on sort of low-end community services, folks that they know in their community, I think that system would be more welcoming to families.
But it sounds like what you're saying is that where you would be relying was with non-governmental organizations, the very groups that are struggling so hard now to provide those kind of services for a variety of reasons. And one of the big ones is that the state's just not paying its bills.
That's right. But if you think from a cost perspective, like even if you don't like the idea of setting up community-based organizations, from a cost perspective, prevention's the way to go.
Yeah.
It's far cheaper to go rather than wait around until foster care is needed. And another area is if foster care is needed, if there could be some changes in financing as well, that would be helpful because we spend a lot of money on the foster care end that could be redirected towards in-home services.
Yeah. Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to finish. My apologies. We have a caller we just can't take because we're air at the end of the time, and I'm afraid we'll have to stop with our thanks to Joseph Ryan. He is Associate Professor in the School of Social Work, University of Illinois, here in Urbana-Champaign. Thanks very much.
Thank you.